You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. Hello and welcome back to Talk the Walk. My guest today is Suella Rizkwala. This name may be very familiar to you, as Suella earned the title of Northern Territory's Social Worker of the Year in 2016. Suella's social work career has spanned more than two decades and has included a variety of roles within the field of child protection and out-of-home care in the Northern Territory. Suella also has a passion for working in emergency response and has lived through and assisted others through a number of natural disasters. Her current roles also include lecturing and supervising social work students at the Charles Darwin University and serving on the board of the AASWNT branch. Suella has qualifications in arts, social work and social policy. Suella, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Lucy.
I know that your career has taken you to so many places and such a variety of directions. It's really hard for me to know where to start, but I am interested in exploring the relationships that you've developed with Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory in your time there. And I guess exploring some of the differences in social work in the NT compared to other parts of Australia where some of our listeners are from. So could you start by just giving us a bit of an idea on your current role, which is Senior Contract Administrator for the Northern Territory region?
So my role is that I'm attached to what they call the Northern Region. So in the NT, we're divided up into three regions within territory families. That's the agency I work for. So the Northern Region encompasses from Borroloola, which is to the east, and all the way to the west to Wadeh, north, all the way to the islands, and it doesn't include Darwin and Palmerston, which is the capital city and the satellite city there. So we have agreements and contracts in place with providers across this region. So I work with the senior directors and directors in that region to deliver services with our third parties providers.
Cool. So give us an idea about what would a day look like for you?
Gosh, it can be anything from a phone call from one of the islands, from one of the providers that we might be negotiating an agreement or a contract with. It could be from a provider that's coming into town that wants to pop in and say hello. I could be writing a memo. I could be making some payments for people. I could be talking to our internal staff about our service providers. I could be problem solving a myriad of issues in relation to the contract. Or I could be asked to provide feedback on documents that the director may not be fully cognizant of or aware of what the implications might be. So my role really is to provide advice, information, support, administrative support. And I'm kind of unique because there's three contract managers for the Northern, like for the NT, one in Darwin, one in Alice and one in Northern Region. I come with a social work background. So what the extra bang for dollar, I guess, that the directors get is that I do understand the operational stuff and also how our NGO providers work with us and how they deliver services for us in the regions. So I could be asked to do all sorts of things that it could be. Like before Christmas, I was in Katherine doing some child protection work for the Northern Region because there was a little bit of a backlog there. And so it's kind of like, well, you know what you're doing, off you go, here's your case list. We did that for 3 weeks and then came back and did my normal jobs. So my day can be basically doing my day-to-day tasks and then being redirected to do something else quite quickly. So we're in the wet season and there's been quite a bit of rain, and if there's an emergency that might come up, I might then be asked to go and work in the emergency management team that we have to help people recover after an event of some sort.
It sounds like, yeah, as a social worker, you bring different skills to the role that perhaps other people in the contract manager's positions don't. What advantage, yeah, do you think that you have? What are the sorts of skills and knowledge that you bring that perhaps others are not bringing?
I think it's the understanding of how the child protection system and how the children in that system live and exist whilst they're in out-of-home care or if they're in that system. And then when we go to do the contracting or making the arrangements, actually understanding what it is, what are our Territory Family Children's are like. So I bring that lived experience of being a CP worker and being an out-of-home care worker and actually knowing what it's like for these children living in a, say, a residential care, for example, placement or a foster care placement, or what it, like the difficulties, I guess, of how hard it is to deliver those services from the child's perspective, because I've had to be that case manager that worked with that those children, those types of children with those high needs.
Sure, and I imagine you're developing quite close relationships with these communities too.
Yeah, you do, and a lot of the times with the work that I've been working with, I've had long relationships with providers. So when I was a student, I used to work with Anglicare in their respite care service, and whereas now, 24 years later, you know, I've jumped the fence and I'm now talking to them about service models and service development. So it's kind of like a real a bit different. And even, you know, people that have been there when I was the student are the people that I talk to now as a person from government. So it's a big curve, and so your relationships are really, really important. I don't think you can do any business in the Territory, whether it's an NTG job or whether it's an NGO or whether you're going out to community, without actually getting the relationship right and upfront and first. Because if that's not done correctly, then there's no way that business can progress.
And can you speak a bit about the kinds of providers that are out in remote communities that you're dealing with?
The ones that I deal with are basically providers that are providing, like women's shelters, for example, which are funded through one of our programs, the domestic family violence, for example. So NGOs like, or local councils may be running them, but they're big entities, and that's because in remote communities there's not a lot of capacity to be able to take on a contract of some sort, and then to be able to fulfil that contract, and then to be able to then deliver on that contract. And so we're working really hard with a lot of our providers to build that skill up. And it's, you know, it takes time, and it really has to be that partnership and walking slowly with that organisation for them to understand what they're actually entering into. But I'm talking in general terms because I need to, I guess, because they're all commercial incompetence type arrangements. So it's about how you do it. And I think it's about having that mutual respect and having that understanding that my timetable might not match your timetable of the organisation or the community, but it's about coming to that middle ground of doing what's important, getting the work happening. So it's time is what I've learned.
Yeah, it does take time for an organisation to build their capacity to be able to fulfil their contractual arrangements. Can you speak about some of the challenges, I guess, for providers in remote communities? What are they struggling with, and what sort of issues do you come across?
The biggest one that I've noticed is that it's the high turnover. So agencies are really, really good at attracting really passionate people and people who are really wanting to make a difference. But when you're faced with the reality of being, you know, 1,000 kilometres away from the nearest KFC, it really becomes a bit of a challenge for some people. Or it could be medical treatment, it could be schooling. And so the challenge, the thing that I struggled over the years, it's like the high churn of people in and out of communities. And when you do have people that do stay in community and love the community life, they're just so enmeshed in the community, and they become part of the community, and it becomes really hard to work out where their loyalties lie. Is it with the organisation? Is it with the funding body? Is it with the community? And that real relationship becomes quite difficult to manage. And I know that with some of the relationships that I've developed, even though I pop in and out of the communities, and depending on what needs to happen, when you see people in town, they know who you are, they remember who you are, and they remember what you say. So it's really important, I guess, to get those working relationships and those respectful relationships happening with people on community. and also knowing what your boundaries are and what's in and out of your remit, I guess, is a good word to use.
I'd like to explore a little bit about your understanding of homelands, because I know that at one point you were acting as manager for strategic initiatives for the Homelands Service. Can you tell us a little bit about the homelands movement and how NT government policy is supporting people to live on country?
When I did that stint, that was probably the highlight of some of the work that I did. And the reason it was a highlight was because it was probably one policy that was really hard to grapple and understand. It was because it was based on individuals who come from a particular area putting their hand up and saying, this is my homeland, this is where I belong, and this is where I want to live. And so that wasn't hard to grapple with, but what was hard to grapple with was that the Homelands Work Unit provided people with the capacity to live there. So it meant that they were eligible to have funds for home repairs and a whole range of funding attached to roads and rubbish removal and a whole lot of activities that each household was eligible for. So for me, it was grappling, because when, you know, in my mind, when was the last time that a NTG or Australian Government initiative said, here's some money for you to maintain your household? And it was done in the recognition that Aboriginal people were connected to their lands and communities, and that this was important. But it also recognised the cost associated with living out remote. And so for me, it was a complete mindset shift on understanding how this policy was actually a really good policy, because it was an enabling policy, and it does enable people to live on their homelands as they choose to. So for me, it really just made me rethink on how policies are designed and who really is the beneficiary of that particular policy.
Right, so it's a good example of a policy which is enabling, like you say, for people to be able to live on country, but in reality, the costs of delivering that policy, does it become unmanageable?
No, it's manageable, but what it enables is for people who are the homeland owners and the property owners, what the policy enables them to do is to actually maintain the quality of life out there. So both the federal government and the NT government ensure that there's electricity, ensures that they've got water supply, and if there's repairs and maintenance, people can actually choose what needs to be repaired and upgraded on the property. And the reason that policy exists is because there is no infrastructure out there apart from what's supplied, and then it's the ongoing maintenance. That's what the policy allows, is the ongoing maintenance of these people's homes, which is unaffordable for even you and I because of the distance from the local providers. So if we lived out in the middle of nowhere and we wanted a plumber, you'd be looking at thousands and thousands of dollars, whereas this policy enables the homelands groups, of the different homeland groups, to be able to pull their money and get resources into the area and to ensure that they do have the rubbish removal, they do have the roads, they do have the electricity and do have the water and the sewerage that they're entitled to. It's an amazing policy.
Yeah. So there is another view by some people who think that it is better for Aboriginal people to be living in concentrated areas where there are services provided.
Well, I know that there's another school of thought that says that people's health actually improves. Mm. So the health outcomes for Aboriginal people do improve when they're on country, because they are eating bush tucker. They know where the food is. Mental health will improve because, you know, people's mental health improves when they're on country where they feel at home and belong. And they're usually with their family groups as well, like different family, you know, like different members of their family have different houses nearby. There are some of the homelands are even evolving into small communities.
You're obviously seeing some of these outcomes for communities, better health, better mental health.
Yeah, we notice it, like when you talk to people, if I'm out of community and they go, oh, I'm going out to my homeland, you can immediately see people's faces smile and, you know, and happy that they're going back to their piece of land. And you can just see just the eyes light up. It's just amazing to watch when people do talk about going out on country. It's almost
like they're going there to refill their souls and their, you know, their strength, I guess. It's where they get their strength from.
Yeah, beautiful. So you mentioned before that relationships are important. What does it take for you to be able to develop and maintain relationships based on trust with Aboriginal people and communities, given that the Homelands policy has been contentious and the federal government has shown that they want to move away from funding homeland communities?
That's happened because I know that the NT government have got the whole budget for it. The relationship with the NTG and the Australian government, you know, I don't have any insights into that relationship, but what I do know is that the push is that the NT is, at the time when I was there, we were managing the budget, really. The money was given to the NT then to manage the Homelands budget. So it's about responsibility, I guess. It's about devolution. I think the Australian government continually devolves a lot of its responsibilities to the different states and territories. You know, that's what happened under SAP 5, under the National Affordable Housing Agreement. The NTG were left to manage the budget.
So I'm also aware that you were called across for a short time to work on the recent Royal Commission into the protection and detention of children in the Northern Territory. Can you tell us a little bit about your role working for the Royal Commission and what it was like for you to be doing this work?
I was pretty excited when I got asked to do that because I'd never worked on a Royal Commission before. We all kind of go, oh, well, what's a Royal Commission? And it is, it's an amazing powerhouse of people sitting down and just putting the records together, really, and providing the information of what happened and when it happened and who was involved. So my role basically was that a request would come in for information, then I would then find the information to answer the question and then send it on to the person who requested the information. So it was activity of revealing everything in the questions being asked by the Royal Commission. So I was in a team of about four or five, and I was at the tail end of the last 3 months of the Royal Commission, and you could just see the exhaustion on people's faces in the team of just being there, you know, 12-hour days, pushing through the work and the requests to meet the requirements of the Royal Commission. It was huge. And just to be part of a team of people that, how can I describe it, committed to providing the information and being as transparent as they can be with what it was provided and what was available was amazing. I did learn how to use a few computer programs, which I was pretty excited about. Yeah, even something as simple as not even just learning that you can have your computer, your G drive, searching twice with your two screens at two different times, which was an awesome skill to learn.
Yeah, right. What about other learnings for you during this time?
The learnings of different skill sets, different people coming together to form a team. So like in our team, there were lawyers, there were social workers, there were admin people, there were people from corrections, juvenile justice, all of us all having different experiences and coming together for one goal, and which was to work as a team to provide the information as requested. So what I learned from that was that we all had different skills and we were all helping each other and like understanding what was being asked and how we all interpreted the questions differently. And because of our different experiences and different skill sets and knowledge bases, that you could spend, you know, 2 hours looking for the wrong thing because you interpreted the question the wrong way and then say, no, that's legal talk, this is what it means. So I learned a lot in those 3 months.
Yeah, it sounds like there was lots of camaraderie amongst people as well as respect for each other's knowledge in that multidisciplinary environment.
And I think it was. And what was really funny was the way that we were set up in the building was all these questions would come from lawyers and they'd be targeted at you to answer the question. And then what was really funny for me was I hadn't realised that that person was sitting about five chairs away from me, because they were the lawyers and we were the research team, but I hadn't actually been introduced to them. And when they finally said, I thought you were somewhere else in another building, they said, no, I just sit over here. It was very funny because when I got there, it was just, here's the chair, here's the question, off you go. And the meeting and the greeting kind of happened around the water cooler.
Oh, right.
Because I thought these lawyers were down south somewhere. in another building or whatever. Like, I had no idea that that's who they were. And we went, and there was kind of like this invisible line, like you really don't, can't really talk to them in the sense of, well, this is your job, that's their job, and you're the researchers. So I think it was just about, because there were no partitions or doors or walls, it's kind of like, that's their work unit, this is your work unit. Yeah, it was very funny.
I guess I've got a more broader question around the state of affairs, I guess, around Aboriginal children and young people's welfare. We know that the Royal Commission came out of concerns, and we also know that Aboriginal children and young people are way overrepresented in the child protection system and juvenile justice sector. So as someone who is really passionate about making a difference for kids and families, how do you see legislation and practices being shaped in the future to try and address these statistics?
I think the biggest one that's out there that I've grappled with is like the concept about local decision making. Have you heard of that?
Yep.
Yeah, so it's become part of practice, I guess. It's about people having a voice in what's happening around them in their location, and it's like place-based decision making, and then listening to what that community has to say about its mix of services and how, you know, families and children should be treated or shouldn't be treated. So I think if we move down that path, because that local decision making is a policy platform, it's then rethinking how we do our day-to-day business, I guess, because in my job, a lot of the stuff I'm doing is being couched within the local decision-making arena, and that's when I have to slow down and have to go, oh, okay, this has to get done now because of these reasons. Well, no, actually, I have to pull back and say it's a local decision-making, and then you have to go back to that particular group and talk to that group and make some decisions and then go again. It's very exhausting in the sense that if you're a bit like me, list-orientated to now going, okay, we're in this vortex of time that I have no control over, it is really going to really change how we do business, I think.
And like we mentioned before, time is one of the challenges, isn't it? Because this is a slow process of going back and forth and proper consultation and talking to people on the ground.
Yeah, and making sure that everybody's happy with the decision, and then, you know, and then by the time you get to where you've actually done something, what you've actually done is probably the capacity building of the individuals in that group as opposed to the actual project, which is the end product. And so I think policy will need to kind of be adjusted, I guess, to realise that if we're going to do a policy for 5 years, it may actually need to be for 10 years to be able to be implemented because of the timeframes of doing that, of using local decision-making principles. Yeah, and with that comes huge cost because it takes longer and it's more expensive, but it's probably the better way to go because we've moved along the continuum of, I suppose, you know, the history of the NT from being managed by South Australia to self-government to now local decision-making, because the Territory is an evolving place. It's, you know, it's the last frontier, I guess, of Australia, of what we've got here in Darwin versus to what you have in, say, Bankstown, New South Wales, are completely different challenges and different issues. But essentially, we've got people that live in the most marginalised communities actually now being given a voice through local decision-making, which is pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And hopefully it translates into real differences for children and families and keeping safe and all those goals that we want to protect children, prevent them coming into the juvenile justice system.
And we also have a lot of families who live on community and live on in remote areas who never come to the attention of juvenile justice, who never come to the attention of child protection because, like everybody else, they're raising their children as everybody else is. Their families are doing well and they're engaged in their communities. The kids are going to school, they're going to the clinic. So when we do talk about Aboriginal disadvantage, we need to also look that there's also people doing really well as well, and we have to remember that. Otherwise, we're going to be continually pathologising people and labelling, I guess, people in a particular brushstroke when it doesn't really apply to everybody. And it's some people or some communities or some families, no different than what happens in Darwin or Katherine or Mackay or Townsville or wherever.
Yes, that's right. So is there some capacity within your role to collect some of those stories where things are working well and using that as a framework, I suppose, for what is possible?
I'm always elevating anything that I see as a good news story within where I work. I always elevate it up to the powers of be, for want of a better word, and always looking for opportunities to tell the people, you know, that I work with and for when all the providers I work with are kicking goals. There's amazing providers in our region that kick above and beyond what they're funded to do by us, but they just do amazing work in very remote areas.
So how do we hear about these stories? Is there a platform where these stories are being shared?
If you wanted to see what all the different regions are doing, you can go on to, say, a couple of the websites, like the West Arnhem Regional Council, for example, has a website, and you can link into what's happening on communities. And each regional council will have what the youth are doing. They'll have newsletters out. Also, a couple of times where I've put articles up on the AASW website around what's happening in the region as well, of good news stories. If people do have a particular interest of a particular community, you can Google that community and you'll find all sorts of information about that community.
I might put some links up to some of the regional council websites that promote some of those stories for people to have a look at.
There's also another site called Bushtel, which is a NTG housing local government type site.
You mentioned before that you've worked in emergency responses. I know that you have a lot of passion for this area and assisting communities after natural disasters like floods and cyclones. I was wondering if you might speak about your involvement in developing and implementing emergency response policy for remote areas of the NT.
If anybody has ever been involved in emergency management or responses, it's a really interesting space to work in, because with welfare recovery, each state and territory has responsibilities for welfare recovery, and each department within the NTG has a different responsibility. So our department's responsible for welfare recovery. So what that means really is, once a disaster's occurred and once the all clear's gone, then we as an agency come in and support people through that disaster. So we might provide emergency relief funding, we might provide food, clothing, we might set up a shelter, we might replace white goods, whatever it is that we're doing. So my first involvement started after the second big flood of Katherine. And we would go out to all the flood-affected people, inspect their properties, and then come back and process the payments that they are entitled to. Because essentially, if you've been flooded out and everything's been drowned, for a better word, it's gone, then you've absolutely got nothing. And just the despair, you know, that people feel when they've lost everything is just phenomenal. And so that was my very first experience. And the last experience I had was when we finished working on Cyclone Marcus, where I was more in the planning cell, where we sat down and worked out how we were going to deliver services to the people of Darwin affected by the cyclone. So the policies exist anyway. We have the procedures and the policies. It's more about the implementation. How do you implement and how do you deliver services? In that role, I guess it's about working as a team. And again, it's a multidisciplinary team, people coming from all over the NT, NTG, our work units working together and co-opting other agencies to work with us. And also agencies like the Red Cross that we have relationships with to deliver services. I've had in my memory when we went to the staging point out at Bachelor in the last flood, 2018, we're seeing all the helicopters taking off at the same time. I think there must have been about 10 helicopters all on the ground, and I thought they were going to go one at a time, but no, they all lifted up at the same time and headed out towards Daly River. It was probably one of the most amazing sights I'd seen with the emergency management stuff. But even when, you know, we go to the shelter, and if we're housing people in town, it's the evac centre, just seeing how quickly everything's mobilised because everybody's working together for the one common goal. And it's, again, it's all relationship based again. It's all based on people knowing what their roles are and what their responsibilities are, and then having excellent relationships with our partners to then make this magic happen overnight. It's almost like an instant city pops up overnight. It's just unbelievable. And we do it regularly. Every time Daly floods, this instant town pops up, recovery centre, stuff happens on community, stuff happens on the highway, stuff happens in the air. It's just amazing.
What's it like for you to be involved in something like that?
I like it, and I like it because it's very grassrootsy stuff. People who are receiving the services aren't, it's not that I want to be gratified, it's just that it's a genuine need and you actually are assisting people when they're at their worst and at their lowest, and you actually are giving them something that's useful to them, which is the assistance that they're seeking. And what I like about it is it's also short term, it's not ongoing, continuous, it's kind of do your stuff, get out, which is that brief therapy, I guess, in a sense. But, you know, the effects of disasters do have lifelong effects on people, but I also know that, you know, we've referred them on and we've given them the tools to get to the next stage, and it's really, that's what you're doing, you're not really doing anything beyond that, but it's good because people know where to go and what needs to happen, like, and access the information they need and then get to the next stage of how they're going to go to recovery back at community or at home. So that's a bit that I like about it.
And it sounds like it's not too demanding on you. It's a short intervention, like you say, a bit of an adrenaline burst, and then people are on their way and they're getting the assistance they need. Yeah. So it's not too draining in terms of your investment of yourself.
No, that's right. But if you ever have the opportunity to volunteer, it's worthwhile volunteering because it's a different relationship. It's different from a social work relationship. It's not intense. It's more about the immediacy, dealing with the immediate issues and what needs to happen now at this point in time. And once everybody can go home, go back, whatever, your job's more or less done in that role, in that emergency, because they've gone back to community, people are going back and they're developing their own personal efficacy. You're giving them the tools just to get through the next 3, 4, 5 days, and then people then have to then go and look after themselves again as they normally would, because, you know, they can go back home, it's safe. That recovery, that immediate stages of stuff that I've been involved in, you're kind of just there. And I think over the years that I've done it, it's just being there and just being available and people coming through and just really knowing that, yes, there is help out there, yes, I can recover, and yes, I'm okay, and now I'm ready to go home. I really like that part of the work, really.
I'm getting a sense from our conversation that you know the territory pretty well, you've been there a long time, and you've had a variety of roles. I was wondering if we could take a little bit of a step back and just look at the development of your career and how you came to start in social work. Was there a turning point in your life when you knew this would be your career path?
Yes, there was a turning point, and it was a huge turning point. So I came to the Territory when I was 3. Then I lived out in Nooka for a few years as a child and gone to Nooka Primary School. In that time, Cyclone Tracy hit. So we were all away for 10 years. And then when we came back to the Territory, I just finished year 12. You know, we were in the period of the recession that we had to have, so employment was pretty rough, non-existent really. And I didn't do well at university. At high school, sorry, to get into university. So I was kind of at a loose end. So one of my friends had said, I'll come and work here with me. So I ended up working in Somerville Community Services as a carer for young people with disabilities. So I did that for about a year or so. And then I realised the day that I was walking around because a lot of the people in the home, young people in the home, were quite severely disabled, you did a lot of the daily living activities. And one day I'd had some human feces on my shirt and I could smell it, and I was walking around and I'm going, there's a mess somewhere that's got to be cleaned up, you know, all the health issues, da-da-da. And then I realised it was on my clothing. That's the day that I realised that I had to get smart. I had to get really smart really quickly, or this was going to be my future. So what I did was I went to night school, got my skills up as one should, because I come from an non-English speaking background. I didn't go to the best schools. I didn't quite get school, you know, in the way that school was being taught, but I also lived in a very marginalised community as well. So the things that I learned at school was how to read and how to write, and that was essentially how I passed high school, I guess. I could read and write, but I couldn't really work out how to be a student, really. So I decided to go to night school. So I picked up History and English under the SABSA, which is the NT South Australia Studies Board, passed those courses, and then got into CDU. So I thought I'd enrol and do psychology. Well, that was, so I enrolled into psychology. After the first year, I failed Psych 101. And I thought, oh, dear, that's not good. Maybe I should do welfare studies. So I swapped and did welfare studies, did 4 units of psych because of all the maths, because all the stats, I just couldn't do stats. It's not my thing. And then I got in and passed the welfare degree, the Bachelor of Arts Welfare. So fast forward 3 years, there was no social work degree. I then went and worked at ANSTI, which is a New Start Towards Independence, which is a homelessness service dealing with the long grasses of Darwin in 92-93. I did that for 10 months, and then the social work degree had started up at the old NTU, the Northern Territory University, before it was CDU. We were, so myself and about 15 of us, we were the first cohort to graduate with social work degrees in the NT. So that was pretty exciting. I managed to get a full-time job working for Somerville and did quite a lot with Somerville and Anglicare and Carpentaria and all that sort of stuff. But that grounding of the hard work in working in disabilities really spurred me on to be a bit smarter and learn how to learn as an adult.
That is a long story of commitment and drive and determination to get where you want to be.
Yeah.
What is it about social work, though, that you really connect with? Is there any particular principles or values or beliefs that are part of who you are that really fits with social work?
I think for me, when I think of my social work and my career, I guess what connects to me is the social justice. When you do work in child protection, because that was my first job as a social worker, was getting to child protection, was just the advocacy work, I guess, you do as a social worker in child protection, where your role isn't really an advocate. When the children are in your care and they're taken into care, you're effectively that child's parent. You're its corporate parent. You're also, you can't be a psychological parent. You can't be anything but that corporate parent, but it's an important role, and you are advocating and you are lobbying and you are doing all those things in child protection for children. So I guess for me it was really looking at, like, the theoretical stuff was about the systems. You know, I'd be lying in bed, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning going, it's so unfair that we can't do this for this child, it's so unfair doing that, you know, you'd have this, you know, rage, you know, against the system, rage against the injustices and why parents are doing what they're doing. But also, you know, your social work mind going, well, the reason the family is in this situation is because of these reasons. And so what I bring to it, I guess, is my compassion for the work that I do and the passion to make things a little bit better, if not much more better, for kids. And I guess when you've done, like I've done 11 years of child protection continuously, and you just look at some of the damage that's occurred to children, it really is that being child focused, I guess, in my practice, and realizing that some of the children have just had horrific lives. Child protection gives you the capacity, I guess, to effect some change, a good change. And other times, you're as a worker, you're doing stuff because there is absolutely no other option. And so my passion, I guess, is really caring about what I do and who I'm doing it with. And I think that's what I bring. I think it's the care factor. Like, I think I care too much sometimes about what I'm doing, who I'm doing it to, and what I hope to achieve out of it. And I think that's what I bring to it, is that care.
So in speaking some of these words, challenging systems, compassion and your passion to make things better, being child-focused and caring too much sometimes, when you hear that back, are there any particular people that come to mind in your life that would know you well enough to realise this is the stuff that you're really passionate about?
I do. I, you know, like my husband, we've been together 20 years and he sees that in me. One of my very good colleagues, Michelle, sees that in me. There are people out there that can see that in me. Even I was telling my cleaner this morning, because I have to have a cleaner, I was saying, oh, one of the colleagues that I'm meeting up with tomorrow had broken her shoulder in a terrible car accident. And we're going to a planning meeting with the association tomorrow for the Australian Association of Social Workers, because I'm on that branch. And I said, it's okay, Jill, I can pick you up. And then I said to her at the end of the day, before I drop you home, did you know you need to go to Woolies to get your groceries? And my cleaner says, oh, that's really, really nice. I said, no, that's what human and decent. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So even the cleaner can see that that's who I am. You know, it's about being generous. And because I've got that Palestinian background, that's part of the culture as well, is to extend and be generous.
I don't know that story. Tell us about your Palestinian culture and the impact or the influence that that's had on you, your life and your work.
It's been huge because my mum and dad, like my dad came out in 1969 and my mum and I came with my sisters came out in 1970 to Darwin. And my dad's a bricklayer and my mum was a mum. And my mother, when she was married, she was only 13. So that was a culture back in the 60s, 70s, you know, the 50s and 60s in Jerusalem, in Palestine. And so part of my recognising how do you raise children or how do you parent children was quite challenging for me because I grew up, like my mother's 69 this year and I'm 52 this year. So there's only about 7 years. And between my eldest sister, she was born in 64 and my mum was born in 1950. So it's about children raising children, I guess. And my mother was a child bride. And for her then to be raising three girls in Australia in the 70s in the territory was an amazing experience. So even now it doesn't feel like, you know, I've ever been mothered, but I do have a mother. And so that challenges me all the time because my mum is still young at heart. She's like one of the girls as opposed to the mother. So yeah, so this because I've got two older sisters, so I'm the third oldest.
That experience of being a child with a really young mum, how has that shaped, I guess, how you see families and how you work with families, or does it?
It does form because how you parent is how you've been parented, I guess. And you know, as a parent, you actually then change how you might parent by having new information or different ways of doing things. My mum was a bit of a laissez-faire mother. She kind of let us run wild, I guess. And my dad was more of an autocratic father. So we had two different styles of parenting. And so the way that I parent, I guess, and the way that I talk to people about parenting is slightly different in the sense of, well, what is it that you hope to achieve? Like, you know, all parents love their kids, but it's about whether it's safe or unsafe. And I guess recognising what is safe, my learnings and my education as a social worker and also the work around here has challenged what in my mind is safe and unsafe and what is acceptable and not acceptable and what is community standard and what isn't a community standard. And so you actually have to come to some decision and your brain has to actually make some shifts in your beliefs as well on what is acceptable and not acceptable.
So what would your mum say? Would she be surprised that you're doing the work that you're doing and that this work is about compassion, it's about focusing on children and care?
She'd say, I'm proud of you, but she wouldn't understand what I do. She just says things like, oh, you're doing a good job. I know you're good at what you're doing. But if you actually tried to have a conversation about social justice, unfairness, compassion, and she'll either go, oh, that's not right, or this is right, but she wouldn't actually have the language skills to actually use those words.
So where do you think these values that you hold come from then, if it wasn't from your parents?
Getting angry, I guess, just seeing things around me. And because I'm one of three, and I didn't really get any hand up or hand out from my parents at all. And I guess it was more about just getting angry and realising what is right and what is wrong and understanding what's around you and coming, you know, connecting the dots, because most parents would support children in those experiences, especially, you know, from the time I was 21 and decided that I was going to go to uni. I just rode my own ride. And I guess it was the influence of having quite passionate lecturers and people around me sitting there and having all that debate and having the education, I guess, to open up your mind to new thoughts and new ways. Because as a Palestinian family, we were quite structured in what we will talk about, what we won't talk about, what you do say, what you don't say. My parents divorced and separated, and we grew up in a family where there was, you know, quite a bit of domestic violence and quite a bit of alcohol and other drugs, alcohol abuse by my dad, that sort of thing. And yeah, and so it's about just finding a different group of people, I guess, to develop and grow. And that's where I guess my social justice had come in, because realising that whilst we had, you know, two parents that loved us and cared for us and raised us, they probably didn't do the best job that they could have done. Like, my two parents do try and do try hard, and they did try hard, but they also came from a position where my dad was, you know, was conscripted to the Palestinian Liberation Army, spent time in jail, you know, my mother being a young person. So they did the best they could, and they were hard workers, even though there was all this other stuff going on. And so by changing my social group and by changing my education and learning about what social justice is and what's fair and what's right, and learning about what it means to be a feminist, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I kind of grew in those years, in those 3 to 5, 7 years. It was kind of, that's where my consciousness had really popped open and realised. And because we grew up in a sheltered way, that my dad was always in control of everything and what we said, who we, all that stuff, the moment that I made the decision that I needed to move out of home at 18, 19, to then, no, I was 21 when I started uni, I moved out of home. And then I knew that if I was going to succeed at uni, I had to move out of home. And that's where the whole world kind of changed.
Yep. Oh, it's been absolutely fabulous talking to you and getting to know you and the fabulous work that you're doing up there in the Territory. I was wondering, because I am aware of time, can you tell me a good news story or an achievement or some sort of sparkling moment from the last few weeks that you'd like to share?
The sparkling moment was when I'd been working on a project that's a local decision project, and we'd had a really rough start with the project, so I came in a little bit later than everybody else, and we'd managed to get the people involved around the table, and then the women had come into town, we'd been talking, and then at the end of the meeting that we had, they gave me a cuddle, which I hadn't expected. It was just spontaneous, and it was a lady from one of the remote island communities and the young coordinator. And the, you know, the relationship had been a bit sort of shaky, and there was all these protocols in place, and it was just full on. And I'd arranged a meeting with our media people for them. And at the end of it, I got a cuddle, and the person that I'm working with, I rang them and I said, guess what just happened? And they said, seriously? And I said, seriously, I think we're on the right path now.
Yeah, you've done something right.
That was really kind of like a bit of a spark that made my day. And the person who came from corporate section said, oh, my God, you've got an amazing relationship with people. I said, no, really? I said, this is how I normally work with people. Like, yeah. it didn't seem that I'd done anything to me, because it's what I do. And she said, I can't believe how well, you know, you worked with these women and they've got a great relationship. I said, you don't know how much hard work that was.
Oh, well, that's what being human's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was really sweet, and it kind of put the icing on the cake of a really difficult 12 months.
So what does the future hold for you? The next 12 months, where is the work taking you?
Well, last semester, during the semester, I taught a communications unit at CDU, on top of everything else that I do that makes me crazy. And I've been doing a lot of marking. So I'm thinking of doing a course to kind of do that part of my career a little bit more and strengthen that part of what I've been doing. So I'm kind of thinking of taking up a bit more study, because I did my master's when my son was about 6 years old, and that was hard enough. But I have he's at uni, so I've got spare time apparently. But also where I was thinking was more looking at just doing a little bit more of that teaching in social work, because I think what it is that the new emerging social workers, a lot of our students at CDU do come from overseas, and one of the challenges that you have is trying to do that cross-cultural education. And so a lot of those students also get employment in the NTG, in our NGO sector. And so I think with what I've done in the last 24 years, coupled with teaching, I think will give students that lived experience as they're in the analogies and in the discussions and the practice groups and stuff like that, I think would be good. I'm also, again, involved in the AASW, and this year we're looking at doing what we call the Bush Odyssey. And what that is we're looking at organising a group of social workers who are interested in joining us at one of the festivals in the NT and starting to do some yarning circles and campfire circles and stuff like that. So I'll be working on that group as well. So that's kind of like where that's my spare time stuff. And if I get tired of what I'm doing, I'm thinking of going back into the field, but going in a remote team, like either to Nhulunbuy or to Katherine or Tennant, because I did that years ago, but just to get back into the field and get my practice up again and hone in my skills and bring what I bring to the table.
Sounds wonderful. So if people would like to connect with you in person or online, how might they do that?
They can do it in person. Yeah, I can provide my email.
Okay, great. I feel like we've only just touched the surface of all the knowledge and wonderful experience you have up there in the NT. I know there's so much more that we could have talked about, but I really appreciate your insights today and thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.